from Louisville Public Media.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit by Louisville Public Media.
Welcome back to listeners. So, Doc, today's conversation is really timely because I'm hanging out with our homie John Mace. You know, he's really into, like, you know, he's really discovering now, you know, black culture, black politics, black issues. And so we were coming from the grocery the other day, and he asked me about, we were talking about education.
Okay.
And he was asking me if I felt like black students, black people are better off since integration, right? Brown versus Board, 1954, which we know is what mandated the integration of public school systems. And I've always said that I really am neither here nor there, right? That I can see benefits. I said, in my opinion, it'll always be both benefits and negatives to it, right? I feel like that there's a lot that people of color have gained, black people have gained from integrated school systems. Mm-hmm. There's also lots that we've lost. And that comes from me as somebody who went to, as I often talk about, a private black Catholic school. I went to where I learned about black programs, had black teachers. Mm. The curriculum was very Afrocentric. Also having gone to like a really, really well-to-do white, you know, white school, right? And recognizing the access to nice computers and good field trips. And so I always have seen the benefits to both. And so I'm really excited today, y'all, to talk to a reporter from the New York Times who wrote a piece called I Love My Skin, Why Black Parents Are Turning to Afrocentric Schools. So please welcome to the show, New York Times education reporter Eliza Shapiro. Eliza, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Yes. So I kind of set up the conversation that I had, but your story is all about why certain parents in New York City school system, in the New York City school system, are choosing to send their children to either private or charter schools, but schools that are definitely black focused. Talk a little bit about what has led some of these parents to do this. Like, is it that the public schools are failing? Are these people anti-integration? What are some of the reasons that people have led people to these Afrocentric schools?
Yeah, so the answer is definitely really complicated. And I would just add that in addition to Afrocentric private and charter schools, there are actually some Afrocentric traditional public schools in New York City that parents are flocking to. So there's all kinds of choices. I spoke to dozens of parents about their reasons for choosing these schools. And one thread I heard a lot is that some parents had sent their children to sort of very integrated schools, very diverse schools that are sort of seen as the paragon of the integrated schools movement. But some of those black parents found that when they entered those schools, they felt a real sense of loss of power, loss of agency, a feeling that the white families around them really had the best, you know, the ear of the principal, the ear of the teachers, that they were really sort of running the show, and that there was a lot of tension around bringing in black culture, black history, sort of black pride into the curriculum, and they actually ended up feeling much more comfortable and supported taking their kids out of those integrated schools in some cases and sending them instead to Afrocentric schools. So that isn't a universal experience, of course. I should definitely note that New York City's public schools are some of the most segregated in the entire country. There's been a huge push in the last probably 3 years to help desegregate the schools. But part of the reason I wrote this article was that I felt like a lot of that push was being run by sort of activist and advocate white parents who really wanted to see more diverse schools. But the voices of middle-class black parents in particular, I thought, were really missing. And I wanted to know how integration had been complicated for them. And many of them, as for you, went to integrated schools and had different kinds of experiences. So I think all of that together has led to this sort of new, renewed interest in Afrocentric schools, which have obviously been around for decades. But there's more enrollment in them in New York now than there has been in years. And there are more Afrocentric schools, period, than there have been in years. So I'd say that's sort of part of what the answer to your question.
Yeah.
No, certainly. And in your article, you also talk about a lot of the parents seem to talk about one of the benefits of sending their kids to Afrocentric schools was getting affirmed in their black identity, right? Learning to love their skin tone, learning more about black history. How for black children, how important is it to have Black history kindergarten through 12th grade? And how does that change their interest in scholastic things, having a sense of Black history, having Black teachers? Like, what from the parents you interviewed, what did they say about why these things are necessary and helpful for their children?
Absolutely. I mean, I think some of these parents in schools that were mostly white or integrated had a sense of racial isolation. And, you know, it's not only the parents I spoke to. I was fortunate enough to speak to some high school students in an Afrocentric school called Eagle Academy who told me that, you know, when their, for example, their English curriculum started getting infused with books by authors of color, and all of a sudden they looked at English differently, looked at English class differently. It's like, okay, someone, you know, is speaking about an experience I can relate to, unlike all these kinds of books I've read through elementary and high school, which sort of seemed foreign to me, but might seem very relatable to a white student. So I think part of it is not only wanting to have Black history as, right, like a few assemblies you do over a few weeks, that it's really infused into the core of the curriculum, into the feeling of the school, is such a sea change from how most schools operate, right, with sort of a more Eurocentric focus. So I think parents really embrace that. And actually what was so interesting is that some parents I spoke to felt like, you know, there was one preschool called Little Sun People where many of the parents I spoke to sent their kids from when they were toddlers. They felt like this school represented so much of what they didn't get. These parents didn't get when they were children, because they had spent so many years after feeling a sense of isolation in schools, a sense of not belonging in schools, and they were so relieved to have this place where their children could be affirmed from the earliest age, right? If you're three or four and you know that your skin is beautiful, your hair is beautiful, you're not going to doubt that when you get to high school and you're one of, you know, say, five Black kids in a school, which is what some of these parents had experienced. So that was really powerful for me to hear.
Yeah, you mentioned Little Sun People, and the founder of Little Sun People is a woman named Phila Barclift.
Barclift, yeah.
Yeah, affectionately known as Mama Phila. So Mama Phila talks about what led her. So I want you to talk about how she opened a school, but she talked, when we think about integration, we often think about, or what happens is you have Black students bust out of their own neighborhoods into white neighborhoods, right?
Exactly.
And so we think that that's the optimal situation. But Mama Phila recounts that for her siblings who were bused from Bed-Stuy to Bay Ridge, that they didn't necessarily have a good experience. What happened to her younger siblings in terms of going from the inner city to these supposed better, you know, whiter schools? What were their experiences like in terms of how they were treated in the school system?
Yeah, so she told me, you know, her siblings had these really traumatic experiences with integration. Obviously, that's an anecdotal experience. It's not necessarily universal, but I think in New York, you know, decades ago, when New York was doing some small-scale busing, she said her siblings were, people spat on them, people teased them, people bullied them. And they, you know, she said very directly, school was a traumatic experience for them. Neither of her younger siblings ended up graduating from high school. And then you have the eldest sibling, Phila, who, you know, has become an educator, right? So she really felt so strongly that the way, at least the method of integration there, wasn't working. And again, you know, I had all these people that I spoke to from my story say, why don't we at least flip this equation of how we think about integration on its head, right? Since Brown v. Board, it's been like getting Black kids out of their neighborhoods and sending them to the, you know, better funded white schools. What about the inverse? What do these all Black schools have to offer, you know, white students in New York, who, by the way, are a minority of the public school system? You know, they're 15%. Black and Latino students represent 70% of the system. So it's about thinking on both sides of the equation, and I think Phila was very interested in that as well.
Yeah. And so Mama Phila, she actually opened up her school on just the floor of her house back in the day, huh?
Yeah, so she felt like she was looking, you know, she had a child, she was looking for a preschool, she couldn't find anything that seemed suitable to her because she wanted, you know, her child to have a strong sense of Black pride and identity. So she was like, you know what, screw it, I'm going to open a school in my house. She had an extra house of a brownstone in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which was then, you know, a much more a poorer neighborhood now has been really, really impacted by gentrification. And, you know, there are houses next to that brownstone where Little Sun People started that are selling for millions of dollars. Wow. But then she had the space. It was very much before gentrification, and she brought in drummers. I mean, one of the most telling anecdotes was that she bought all these children's books, right, for the kids, but all the kids in the children's books were white. They had blonde hair. They had blue eyes. So she took a brown crayon, and she told me she spent hours coloring in the faces and eyes and hair to tell these toddlers that, you know, a white blonde kid didn't need to be the norm in the books they read, which I thought was really powerful.
Doc, my mother, you came to her tree trimming party. All her Santa Clauses.
Yes, Jackie, Jay's mom, painted all of her Santa Clauses brown.
She would go and buy stuff, and she would paint. She's a proponent of that. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I mean, we clearly know, right? Mindful, thoughtful folk know that children, especially children from marginalized communities in terms of race or socioeconomics, need the affirmation as well as the education, right? We've had study after study that shows that students of color in particular are much more successful when they see themselves reflected not only in the teachers and staff, but the curriculum as well as having affirming images of themselves and history on the wall. Why aren't public schools, in your opinion, getting on board, right? Some in New York clearly are that have Afrocentric curriculum embedded within them. But why don't schools across the country take up these studies and start changing their curriculum? Why isn't it more standardized?
Because it's not mandated. Like if a school wants to become Afrocentric, they can. But if it's just a regular school, they're not mandated to have necessarily an Afrocentric curriculum. Is that the case in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question with a few answers. Logistically, I would say, you know, it's been easier for some of these principals I talked to really open their schools from scratch, their Afrocentric schools from scratch, you know, create their own vision of what a school should be rather than taking an existing traditional public school and sort of transforming it. So I think just logistically, there are some limited opportunities for that. But I think your point about the research is spot on, right? We know that this cultural affirmation works. And I think what's so interesting and sort of complicated about this subject is it's not like anyone, you know, is opposed to having their kids in school with white kids or Asian kids or Hispanic kids, right? Like, I think everyone feels that diversity is a great, you know, sort of possibility and hope. But I think really what the parents told me about integration was it's not that on its face wrong, but that schools are not prepared to really become integrated because they don't have so many of these essential building blocks you need for all kids to feel included. So they don't have culturally responsive curriculum. You know, they haven't taken a look at their Western canon in terms of history, in terms of what books they read, and made sure it actually represents not just European and white culture. You know, they don't have educators necessarily who are either educators of color or who have gotten really rigorous bias training or thought about what it means, for example, to be a white teacher teaching a classroom of Black and Latino children. So I think it's really about taking a step back, looking at integration as it can be a laudable goal, but what foundation do the schools have to make sure that all kids are really welcomed and included and not just basically the white students.
Yeah. You talked to the dean of the school there at Ember, and the dean, their name is Aliza, is that right?
Yes, Alyssa,
Alyssa. So Alyssa recognizes it's not enough to just have a really, really good Afrocentric school, that oftentimes, as I mentioned, I went to private schools that were very, very Afrocentered. I learned cultural pride, but they don't often have the resources. And so she was very, very determined that her school would be able to provide the same opportunities or similar opportunities to students in white private schools. And so what kind of stuff did they do? They went to Africa, for example, for 6 weeks. What kind of things did they do to be on par with these other schools?
Exactly. So I would say, to your point, it's really for a lot of these principals and teachers and deans of these Afrocentric schools, it's about leveling the playing field, right? I heard over and over again, the kids in this public school should have the same resources, the same access to everything that, you know, wealthier, typically white kids would have in a private school. So at Ember Charter, which is in Bed-Stuy, Several of the middle school kids spent the first 6 weeks of the semester in South Africa learning about African culture and heritage. They have these sort of assemblies that you would maybe find in typically find in a private school, where they come together. You know, I went to a private school for part of my education. I had never thought of, you know, been to an assembly before, and then all of a sudden you have these weekly assemblies where everyone can get together and talk. That's like a really important part of the fabric of the school. It's just like trying to bring in as many resources, tons of mental health resources, right? In a private school or a wealthy public school, you'd have as many guidance counselors and social workers as you would want. That's not always the case in a school in Bed-Stuy. So it's about bringing the resources to bear just to level the playing field, as I said.
Tell us about, how does Beyonce play into your story? Beyonce Super Bowl, the Super Bowl 2016, what happened?
But I love that part. I love that part before you answer. I love that part because every time I walk into my second class of the day, which is in late afternoon, my students have taken to putting Beyonce.
I saw that on your projector.
On my projector. So like every time I walk in my classroom, Beyonce is playing.
But yeah, so how does Beyonce play into your story?
Yes, I was very excited about that. I mean, the school is very intentional with how they're helping the younger kids, right? These are not high school kids, not middle school kids. These are like second and third graders in an assembly talking about Black culture, Black heritage, very intentional about how they sort of bring them into the conversation and make it relevant to them. So I sat in on an assembly where they were talking about, how does the music I listen to relate to my culture? How does it make me feel? Does it make me feel good about being a Black person? Does it make me feel strong? And so there was a discussion about Cardi B, and there was a debate, and then the teachers brought in a projector and projected Beyonce's Super Bowl performance in 2016, where she was singing, you know, "You Just Might Be a Black Bill Gates in the Making," and all the kids screamed and they were so excited. So it was really trying to show them how the images and the culture that they digest in their own lives, obviously like a celebrity that they love, actually speaks to a much broader point about listening to music that is affirming, that that is culturally relevant. And I think the lesson came home for them there.
We talked a lot about Black students and white students. Where do Latinx students fit in? Are there Latinx students or Asian students attending some of these schools?
So there are, at Ember, Ember Charter, which I mentioned, there are a really high percentage of Latinx students. I can't remember the exact number, but Latinx students are very much welcomed. I mean, to be clear, in these schools, any child can apply. They obviously draw a very high number of Black students, but a lot of the lessons and a lot of the ideology really, really works for Latinx students as well. And, you know, for example, at Ember Charter, they have an affirmation they say every morning about loving your hair, loving your skin. They say it in English, and then they say it in Spanish. But I would say it would be obviously mostly Black students, then Latinx, and then a pretty small number of Asian and white students. But that may change as the schools sort of become more in the mainstream and there's more of them and they just gain more, people find out more about them. Because they're high quality, they're mostly high performing, high quality schools.
Yeah, I tell you what, as I mentioned, this is a story that certainly is universal. It's something we're dealing with here in Kentucky with our latest governor and the push towards charter schools.
And I want them to incorporate this kind of curriculum here just because every time I want to talk about a particular, you know, set of conditions in the world, I have to do so much history
talk. We'd be in class, and like, you're just like, okay, who's heard of Brown versus Board? And your students are like, you're like, really, y'all?
I mean, the public education system, I mean, especially we're talking about here in Kentucky, K-12 just does not prepare these students for any conversation that they're going to have in a college classroom. It just doesn't. I mean, they don't have any sense of colonialism, enslavement, what that has done to the United States. They don't know, or they don't know about Black power and civil rights, the Black arts movement. I mean, so those things I have to constantly supplement, even when I'm talking about, in my course, Black Lesbian Lives, right? I got to talk about all these things because they have no context
for
what these theorists are talking about, you know?
So all that to say, Eliza, thank you so much for doing your story. I mean, it really has been eye-opening. I mean, it certainly makes a case. You know, and as I mentioned, it helps make things a lot clearer for me in terms of what the benefits are of having African-centered schools. And so, listeners, this has been Eliza Shapiro, New York Times reporter on education issues. Eliza, thank you for being with us, and please take care.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell people who we are.
You're listening to Strange Fruit by Louisville Public Media.
As much as ever before, you need reliable, in-depth journalism. Our job at WFPL is to give you the facts and keep you informed, to provide context and make connections. We believe that makes our community a better place to live, and that's something worth supporting. Become a member today. Donate online at WFPL.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit by Louisville Public Media.
Welcome back to listeners. Doc, I'm super excited. My favorite thing about the winter going into the spring is that it's like theater season. I've had my feel. Like, I've been to see, what, Pipeline? I've been to a couple different productions, Pipeline Actors Theater, of course, and there's been all kind of productions. I'm really excited to, you know, the good thing about doing, like, this radio thing is we get, like, complimentary tickets to stuff, so I get to, like, basically see everything for free.
I know. Not that I wouldn't pay. And you really, like, I only have been to the theater with you.
Because I've dragged you. When you first moved to Louisville, like, 10 years ago, I dragged you. You were like, the theater.
I'm like, you can't talk to in the theater. You can't clap. You can't, right? There's no signifying.
But you loved it. You loved it. And you could take drinks, especially, like, in case Kentucky's for the Arts. You can take your cocktail.
I love it.
It makes it a much more enjoyable experience. So all that to say, I'm super excited for a production that's running this month, y'all, at the Bunbury Theater. It's called The Green Book. It's by the playwright Calvin A. Ramsey. So I'm really excited to introduce you all some of the directors and cast of The Green Book. So give it up for the cast and directors of Green Book in the studio today. Please. So let's introduce everybody. First, we have co-director David Chack. David, say hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Wonderful. Co-director Karen Edwards-Hunter.
Hello, how are you?
Delightful. And then a star of the show, Tyler Madden.
Hello, hello, everyone.
Thank you all for joining us. Yeah. So, David, The Green Book. Now, there's also a movie that's kind of making its way. It's unrelated, not directly related.
Right.
The Green Book tells the story of what? What does the phrase Green Book come from? It's historical.
Right.
It was a real thing.
Right, it was a real
thing. What was the Green Book? And then I'm going to ask Karen a little bit about what this play tells us. But what was the Green Book to begin with?
Yeah. Well, Victor Hugo, who was a postman, and then he got this idea in the 1930s, actually from Jewish books that were similar, which were places where Jews could go in order to have kosher food and have places that would not keep them out, because especially in the 30s all the way up through the 50s, Jews were also restricted in areas that they could live in. So he thought this was an amazing idea. It's an amazing idea not only because it provided safety, but it was an amazing idea to promote African-American culture and Black culture. And that's what Victor Hugo was all about. So that's really what this play is about. And I know that the film, people are looking at both of them together and saying, oh, I already saw The Green Book. Well, I'm telling you now, if you haven't seen this play, you haven't seen The Green Book.
Yeah. Now, of course, being a Southerner, I remember hearing about the March on Washington, Doc, when Black people from the South went to D.C. from the March on Washington. They had like a little pamphlet that said, these are the cities in which you can stop. These are the restaurants that would be cool. Pack you some fried chicken because you can't stop everywhere. So I've always heard of how-to guides that people carried around back and they're like, safe places to stop. So
Karen, and I just love that. I mean, because that's like really, really the community being empowered enough to create these kind of resources during times of struggle. You know.
Yeah. So Karen, do we meet the Davis family in this play?
Yes.
The Davis family, who are they and what are they preparing? Who are they preparing to host?
The Davis family is one of the families that is listed in the Green Book as a safe place to stay. They have hosted over 20 years, approximately 200 visitors on the road. And on the day that the play starts or takes place, Mrs. Davis has invited W.E.B. Du Bois to come and to give a lecture. And so that's what the big hubbub is all about. This is one of the biggest days in Jefferson City, Missouri.
All right. Yeah, I mean, Du Bois coming to your house.
I mean, I love it.
You roll out the red carpet.
So where is there tension in the play or a conflict of sorts? I don't want to spoil it for the audience, but just talk a little bit about some of the other characters that might be in the play.
Well, on this particular day, the Davises are hosting several different guests. There's a young businessman from Harlem, Tyler plays that role, who's there selling advertisement for the Green Book. Mm. There's a army captain and his wife, Jackie, who are staying there. And like I said, they're all staying there. There's all this big hubbub about preparing for Dr. W.B. Du Bois. and then a Jewish Holocaust survivor shows up at the door.
Oh, wow.
Tyler, why does that become an issue? What's the deal? What's the conflict between, I mean, I guess they weren't expecting the Jewish people to come up. Like, what is the conflict in terms of what we have to learn about segregation and anti-Semitism?
The conflict, and it shows between my character, Keith, and the Jewish character, Jacob, because here this guy comes in, and Keith just looks at him as like, wait, he's another white man. So he's looking like, he's a little cautious about him. He's like, who are you? Why are you here? Why are you staying in a Negro house? Like, so he's a little bit confused. There's a wonderful part in the play where I kind of like, at first I'm like, I like him, but I'm like, wait, man, this is confusing. This is throwing me off because you're a white man, you know what I mean? And it bothers me that you're here because he's not used to that. Yeah. But then later on, he learns that that Jewish people have, and African Americans during this time have a similar issue during this time. And he's just learning this a little
and
bit.
And having this take place in the 1950s, really right after the Holocaust. Yeah. I mean, the amount of time between when this fellow gets out of the camp, which Calvin, based on real stories, he went to the Holocaust archives that were in at Emory College when he was doing research on an African-American soldier who was a photographer, William Scott. This is a real person who was with General Patton's army, and he was one of the first people to get into the camps to take photographs of the concentration camp victims who were left alive, or he took photographs of many of them while they were dying.
Yeah.
And some of these photographs are just so chilling. And these were the people, and we depict this in the show, to say that there's conflict, I mean, there is conflict. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's dramatic tension. But the conflict, to some extent, is more from the outside, which we know is there, and not so much from the inside. We see Tyler's character, Keith, who's an up-and-coming businessman, and he's working for Victor Hugo Green, and he's an entrepreneur. He's promoting himself, but yeah, so what? He's promoting something about African Americans, which is said, you know, we can be there just like any white guy, and we can be there and promote ourselves and make money and promote our people as well.
Certainly. Mm. This is for any of you all. To what degree was the skepticism, right? So your character sees this white dude show up, this Jewish white dude. To what degree, either from you all's own knowledge or from the play or what you've heard, to what degree was the skepticism founded? I mean, here you literally have a book that's all about safety for black folks, right? About places you can go. Hopefully you ain't got to interact with no white people, you know? But like, so you're expecting Du Bois, in walks a white guy. Like, socially, what was the tension like during that time? To what degree was his skepticism justified, even if he had to kind of work through some of that and see the similarities between their similar experiences?
Purely because he looks at him as a white man. Even just being on the set, like, I think about, like, how Keith looks at it. And, like, when I open there's a part where I open the door and I see Jacob, and I'm like, this is the first time I see him.
Mm.
And in my mind, from my perspective, looking through Keith's lens, I'm like, wait, if this was me, if I can see 1956, I'm like, wait. And the fact that the neighborhood that we're living in is a predominantly African-American. Actually, it's all African-American neighborhoods.
It's right near the college. That,
yes.
Okay. It's an African-American college.
So the fact that you have this white man, who I see as a white man, coming in this African-American neighborhood, yeah, that's where I'm like, what the heck are you doing here? Yeah. You know what I mean? And so it's just from that perspective.
And during that particular time, see, the Jim Crow laws are still prevalent.
Yes.
Segregation has reared its ugly head and has been going on for a long time. But there are laws in place that says that whites and Negroes cannot stay under the same roof.
Yeah.
So it's even for him to ask for a room is illegal.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Wow.
And Calvin is also, to some extent, taking on what's going on today, even though, of course, the play is a historical one. He's trying to say that, look, a lot of these issues, I mean, a tremendous amount of these issues are happening today. The segregation that took place during Jim Crow that caused the need for the Green Book, we can see that still being part of our culture and part of our institutional life today. There's no question about that. And then the conflicts that are coming up today. And we want to, you know, we don't address this in a way directly okay. in the play, but we know that there are conflicts coming up between Jews and blacks yeah. in different places. And Calvin, who's an African-American who lived through this time period, said, look, I want to write a play that shows that we can come together and that I remember Jews that I lived with in Baltimore, and these were some of the most incredible people I grew up with, and they brought me into their homes, and they took care of me. And then he moved to North Carolina, where there were hardly any Jews in the towns that he lived in, and he saw anti-Semitism, and he couldn't understand it because the Jews he knew were wonderful people.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure if any of you all are Louisvillians, but I think about the case the last couple months of the two black folks at Kroger who were shopping, and they were killed by a white supremacist gunman. Doc, you know about this. We think about the Tree of Life congregation, the Jewish synagogue in Pittsburgh that also had a white supremacist come in and shoot up.
Yep.
We have the church down south a couple years ago. Dylan Roof shot it up, right? So Karen, what can folk learn? Folk who may, because that's the thing about not just President 45, but society in general is designed to make us afraid of one another, right? There are a lot of reasons because we don't spend a lot of time with people who are different races or different anything. But what can people learn? I might say, well, what do I have in common with a Jewish person? What do I have in common with someone who is LGBT? What can people learn from this play about people having more in common than they have different?
First of all, I think if we start looking at each person as an individual and not looking and classifying them as a certain group, a certain type or whatever, and start to begin to break down the barriers. And if we start looking at what we have in common, we'll find out that we're more alike than we actually are different. You mentioned the murders of the two people at the Kroger store. I happen to know one of them very personally, graduated from high school with Maurice Stallard's wife. And the fact that he was murdered hits home really, really close. What can we learn? We can learn, as David said, that we can work together, that we can tear down the barriers. And because society is literally pulling at Jews and Negroes
yes.
and trying to have them live marginalized lives, that it, together we can work to break down those barriers and that we can create something new and different, especially in today's time and in the climate that we're living in. You know, racism has reared its ugly head, and it's always been there.
Always, never gone away. Yeah.
But it is much more evident and prevalent today than it has been in years. Yes.
David, why is it important to tell these types of stories? Why, you know, African American theater, black narratives, historical narratives, why are these things still important in 2018, 2019? Why is it important to still talk about what happened in the 60s, 50s, 70s, 80s even?
Well, when we look back at the past, we always look back at it through the lens of what's going on today. And as we do that, we actually start to see that we can not only learn from it, but we have more understanding of what's going on today. We can see that what happened in the 50s during the time of the McCarthy era, where Jews and blacks were equally being blacklisted in Hollywood and on Broadway. We just did a Jewish joke as part of our Spiel Bunbury Identity Theater project, and the Jewish joke is about the blacklisting of Jews in Hollywood. And Baron Kelly was there, you know, from University of Louisville, and he said a lot of African Americans couldn't get into film anymore. People like Paul Robeson were blacklisted. Their salaries were cut, and their passports were taken away from them, and then they found a place to go on Broadway and in theater in New York. And I said, and he said, and all of these white directors brought them in. And I said, and who were these white directors? And he said, Jewish directors. And this is, you know, these are the intersections that we can't forget. And a lot of people also think, oh, anti-Semitism, that just happened in World War II. That just happened with the Holocaust. You know, I could name so many incidents that don't get reported in the major newspapers, which I'm sure you could name so many incidents with African-Americans and people of color that don't get reported in the major newspapers. And this incident in Pittsburgh just woke us all up. You know, we got woke on anti-Semitism now, and it's getting worse and worse And I'm afraid for our country. I'm afraid for this, you know, like you say, this president that is using all of us in order to promote an agenda, which is an agenda that's going to drive us apart.
Yeah. No, certainly, certainly. I mean, it sounds wonderful. I mean, the play sounds like it's complicated. It'll make you think. What have some of the rehearsals been like? I mean, these are really emotional, mentally challenging issues that this play brings out, like such as you mentioned, race, the intersection of race, ethnicity, the solidarity between folks of different races, Jim Crow segregation, right? You have someone like Du Bois who ended up, you know, basically retiring in Ghana and in his real life and became an expatriate of the United States because of McCarthyism, and they basically ousted him out of the country. So all that kind of stuff is going on. And so, like, what has been the most, I'd say, challenging thing about getting this play together during the rehearsals?
For me as a character, mm-hmm. This play has a unique way of texturizing the issues of race and racism, especially during this period of time. And just to kind of just put the image in your head and just about the things that happened. Like today we can talk about the Holocaust and we can talk mm-hmm. about the civil rights situation. But then when you're doing a play about it, because when we're building a character for it, we're texturizing everything that these people went through. I'm texturizing what Keith feels like, what an African-American man feels like in 1956. I'm texturizing what this man who just got in America, well, about 4 or 5 years, just got into America about 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. after the Holocaust. So I'm texturizing everything that this man is telling me. So that has been difficult for me. And then towards the end of the play, the difficult internal part for me is what happens in the end of the play, which you guys have to come out and
yes,
find out what
yes,
happens.
Yes, yes, certainly.
So, yes.
As a director, I think one of the most difficult things as we're going through the rehearsals, I'm sitting out there watching them perform and I'm suspending my disbelief. Mm. And they're taking me into this world that they're creating on the stage. And one of the more difficult things for me is to try to not let them take me under, because I am so susceptible, because I'll go under. And I have to be as objective as possible, but I can find myself, especially in the second act, being drawn in. Mm. And I'm sitting there crying and thinking all these different thoughts. So as a director, that's good, and it could be bad.
Mm-hmm. I could only imagine, yes.
David, this play runs this month, February, February 9th until the 24th. Where can folks go see it? Where's the theater?
Yeah, the theater is just right around the corner from here at the Henry Clay.
Yes.
On Chestnut and 3rd, and yes. It's on the third floor. It's a beautiful theater, and I don't know how many people in Louisville know about it. Because,
we've been to several productions at the Henry Clay.
You guys are great, and we really need to let people know more about it. And this is one of, as I said, three plays now that we've sponsored under the Bunbury Spiel Identity yes. Theater Project. We're planning a number of others, and they're all about intersections of culture. It's not just about Jewish identity or about doing Fiddler on the Roof. As much as I love Fiddler on the Roof, you know, that's not the only Jewish play that exists. Yes. So I just want you to know that right now.
Right. So
I'm not going to do Yubba Dubba Dye right now.
Bunbury Theater, of course, is at 604 South 3rd Street.
Right.
And then you guys are also having a series of talkbacks, right, and discussions
yes.
after the play. So you have one February 9th, February 10th, 15th, 17th, 21st, and 23rd.
Yeah, just a shout out especially to your audience here. We have mm-hmm. Yatasha Womack,
okay.
who is a well-known Afrofuturist. She's written a lot about Afrofuturism. She's an interviewer as well, and she's on my board in Chicago. My project starts in Chicago, actually, and I bring stuff here and
yes.
you know, work on stuff there. So Yatasha has been on my board almost from the beginning. She's wonderful. And she'll be there both Saturday night and then on this panel that we have with Sadiqua Reynolds.
Yes.
And,
from the Louisville Urban League. Yes.
That's mm-hmm. right, from the Urban League. And Morris Weiss, who's one of the leaders of Jewish Hospital, being not only integrated but being a pioneer in bringing African-Americans and people of color into the medical profession and creating connections between the medical profession in Africa with Jewish Hospital here in Louisville. He's 85 years old and has a tremendous amount of history behind himself And he'll be on that panel with Sadiqua, plus Fred Whitaker, who is a well-known Holocaust educator in the area. Fred Gross is going to be joining us, who's a Holocaust survivor, Saturday night. So, as you say, a tremendous number of really great people throughout the entire run of the show. You can check out the other panelists and talkback leaders on the Bunbury website.
Yes, which is bunburytheater.org. Tickets are really, really affordable. I mean, they're as low as $8, or they range from $8 for students. And there's actually some postcards circulating around town, y'all, for $2 off. So students under 25, $10. Seniors, $19. General admission, $22. Karen, who are some, give a shout out to your actors. Who are the folks who are actually in your production? Make sure we say all their names.
Okay, Carl Seitz, Tyler Madden, Kayla Ross, Brittany Patillo,
okay,
and Marquita Howerton, and Joe Morton,
and Robert Thompson.
And Robert, and he likes to be Lewis Robert Thompson.
Yes. And actually, shout out to Lewis Robert Thompson. His wife actually works here. She works here at WFPO. So y'all, have a pretty robust cast. We'll tell you what, we appreciate y'all stopping by. Tyler, when you make it big and you go to Hollywood, don't forget us. Can we come back and get, like, an invitation to the Oscars?
I love Louisville, man. All right. I love Louisville. Louisville's my second home.
All right, good. Well, thank y'all so much for being here and break a leg, as they say.
Yes, thank y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right, before we go, it's time for Juicy Fruit.
Juicy Fruit.
Hot topics. We haven't sung the song in a while.
What? Juicy Fruit?
From the beginning. How's it going?
Okay.
Juicy Fruit, the taste is gonna move ya.
Yes.
If listeners, if you're under like 25, you probably do you know the song? Yeah. If you're under like 20-something, you're probably under 30. You don't know.
No.
But they used to be the Juicy Fruit is a chewing gum.
That one and Mentos.
Mentos fresh and full of life. Oh, I love that. Oh, my goodness.
That was back in the day when commercials had jingles.
Let's do an episode, Doc, where we talk about our favorite, like, jingles.
From the
past.
And
I also want to do an episode where we talk about our favorite theme songs from, like, sitcoms and stuff.
Okay.
So put that in the queue.
Okay.
Anyway, time for Juicy Fruit. What you got?
So, first up for Juicy Fruit is actor Liam Neeson's comments recently to The Independent. So, in a bizarre interview, Liam Neeson talked about a family member being raped and finding out the race of
the assailant.
And in an interview, he talked about how he harbored these really racist thoughts and feelings to the point where he went upstairs after he heard got a bat or some kind of weapon and wanted a direct confrontation with a black person.
He actually started walking the streets.
Let's
hear from him in his own words and then come back to you. Is that okay?
Yes.
So this is him describing, as you mentioned, he's on an interview with The Independent.
Mm-hmm.
And he's describing, he finds out the assailant's black, and he wants to go peruse the streets and beat up a black person.
Yes.
I have an up and down areas with a cosh, hoping I'd be approached by somebody. I'm ashamed to say that. And I did it for maybe a week, hoping something. Black bastard would come out of a pub and have a go at me about something, you know, so that I could kill him.
So he talks about a kosh, which is a stick or a baton, a bat.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that he walked the streets hoping to run into, to who?
To a black person.
Okay.
And
now, not this sailor in particular.
No, I mean,
he was saying that he was
seemed like it was geared toward any black person.
Yeah, he was saying that
he
was so mad at black people, he was going to beat up any black person that like, tried him.
Mm-hmm, he felt like, and, you know, in the same interview, he did say, I'm ashamed to say that. And I did it maybe for a week. Okay, so did it for a week.
Yeah.
So that means that, I guess that meant that he was walking up and down the streets trying to find a black person to murder, I guess, I know, for a solid 7 days, hoping some black bastard would come out of the pub. So, yeah, I mean, it basically was a week in the past that he did this, but I just don't understand. And I guess it's the emboldenedness of the times that we're living in, or maybe Neeson thought, because these were past thoughts or past recollection or obsession, that it wouldn't translate the way in which it did.
Tough, yeah.
Yeah, like, oh, wow, Liam Neeson overcame his racism. That was a past racist thought, but now he doesn't have any.
And just for context, he was doing it. He was promoting a movie. And I guess the movie, the
character,
is about revenge. And he was saying, I can relate because there was a time when I was vengeful, but it then it bordered on racist. Yeah.
Yeah, and I hate it because I really enjoy most, if not all, of Neeson's films. I mean, especially like The Gray and Taken.
I feel like you turned me on to Taken. I feel like you're the one who turned me on to Taken series.
I like Neeson as an actor, but he has to be canceled. I mean, he has to be canceled.
You know what? Ava DuVernay pointed out the absurdity, white privilege. That basically, imagine if this were Will Smith that had said this about a white person, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then she also pointed to Melania Trump as an example of white privilege. That's a very provocative photo she had taken when she was a model, and said, what if that had been Michelle Obama, right?
Oh,
so for people who don't get white privilege, it's the ability for white people to say and do certain things.
Yep.
If a person of color, especially a black person, had done the same thing, the reaction would not be...
They would be punished, they would be scrutinized, right? And in some cases, they might go to jail, or people would question their worth in a particular
role.
Their morality, everything.
I mean, you also have, the governor of Virginia...
Who was dressing up in blackface.
Still unfolding, but, there was a yearbook photo of him in blackface.
Yeah.
And initially he said, okay, it was me, I'm sorry. Then he went thought about it, and now he's saying, well, it wasn't even me.
I know.
Then he just completely flipped the script and denied that it was even him.
I know. Because I think that's the thing, right? I mean, I think that the way in which racism is understood now is that it's casual. It's casual racism. It's laissez-faire. It's light, and we can kind of move boundaries and move past things. And so for him, when he's that age and he's getting dressed up in his blackface with his friend in the Klan robe, they're like, oh my God, it's like so fun. It's so awesome, right? And now in the times that we're living in and it surfaces, now it's like, I would never do that. I can't believe that the picture, I mean, stopped me. And it's like, oh my God, just save that.
Well, just like the interview we did earlier in the show with the Green Book, white people far too often thought about racism as this very overt, physical
racism was acted out, lynch mobs, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
They thought that meant that I'm in the Klan. They didn't think it meant like, oh, I say racist jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Or I dress up as a black person. Oh, I say the N-word casually, but then now people are seeing that all the stuff they did 20 years ago has come back to bite them in the tail.
Mm-hmm.
And 20 years ago, I'm sorry, it was not okay, despite what Tommy Lord and anybody else said, it was not okay to do blackface 20 years ago.
No, it's never been okay. It's never been okay.
But maybe in the 20s, when it's never been okay.
But I'm saying
socially, like white people's doing it.
Yes.
But definitely not, since we've been alive, has it been a thing that's like, okay, this is what people do as a part of Hollywood acting.
Mm-mm,
I don't know.
Mm-mm.
So what's up with that, with this bird that's making headlines?
Oh my goodness, I love...
Your new favorite bird, your new favorite wild animal.
It's a rare intersexed bird that was spotted in Pennsylvania. Jeffrey and Shirley Caldwell have been attracting birds for 25 years, and Shirley was looking out her window and came across this intersex cardinal. So as you know,
I love cardinals
too, because if you blow kisses at them when you see them, it's good
you
luck.
Do say
That's
that.
What my
you
mama
do say that. Yes.
My mama says that. I teach that to everybody. And so this cardinal, you know that in the animal kingdom, the boys are brightly colored because it is their duty to attract the, women birds or women animals, right? So boy peacocks are more beautiful. I mean, I wouldn't say more beautiful, but they're more bold and colored.
And flashy.
And so we know and we're familiar with the red cardinal, but the ones we recollect in our mind are usually male because they're bright red. And the women cardinals are usually just have hints of red, which I love because they're like, they have like different shadows and blushes, like, right? They're not primarily red. So this, because this bird is intersex, they share characteristics of both male and female cardinal birds.
Yeah.
And so they're seen as, they're called bilateral geandromorphs, which I love that term. And that just means having characteristics from these two sexes. And they're called, and so that means that instead of, for birds, their sex chromosomes are called Z and W.
Okay.
And it's the females that have a single copy of each Z and W, whereas males have two of the same. So they have two Zs. So sex cells nuclei, including sperm and eggs, usually have only one copy of each chromosome. Males produce only Z-carrying chromosomes, and females produce either Z or W-carrying chromosomes. And so this particular bird has all of them. So they haven't named the bird or anything like that, but the bird.
Literally, if you look at the photo of the bird, it's the body looks half.
I mean, she's
in terms of the color scheme.
I love
it's half bright
it,
red.
Yeah.
And then half, and then
like when you look at the picture, the bird, they are literally like half they're like kind of light brown, and the other half they're bold red, and then they have specks of red in the brown side too. I mean, I just love. I love them.
And apparently, I heard somewhere that the bird got a boyfriend. Yeah, I heard that the bird has a male companion, and so the bird.
Oh, does it really?
The bird has one up on me, child. And I'm still over here single in the winter time. But shout out to the bird.
Oh yeah, it does say that. It says, "We may find out soon." Shirley Carwell says the cardinal is always in the company of a particular male. We're happy they're not alone. She says. And so they have a bae.
So even the wild animals out here would love us, and I'm still sitting here singing these streets.
Oh, my God, stop.
On that note, we're out of time. Thank you to all today's guests, to Alana Shapiro, to the folks from Green Book, and, of course, to you all, the listeners, for tuning in every week. But we are out of time. We'll be back here next week. Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our editor is Laura Ellis. Our engineer is Kojin Toshiro.
For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at strangefruitpod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.